Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And we are live, and we are continuing to be live on whatever station you may be hearing us on. As far as I know, I know that there are some stations moving, or some shows moving day parts in the business, or actually just one. And all of our affiliates, including Sirius Satellite Radio and Seattle, San Francisco, Pittsburgh, Grand Rapids, right across the country, we're hearing from all of our affiliates that they're keeping our show live where it is, and that's really, really good news because, you know, when somebody's coming after you, ain't no fun. But we're doing well, and the show is growing. In fact, we're going to be picking up a few new affiliates over the next few weeks. It is Friday, the first hour of our program, and as always, for several years now, Congressman Bernie Sanders, now Senator Bernie Sanders, or Senator-elect Bernie Sanders, with us our Brunch with Bernie segment. Bernie, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Always great to have you here. You're in Burlington today.
I am in Burlington, that's right. Be in Washington on Monday, but in Burlington today.
Well, say hi to Vermont for me.
I will.
I miss it. First of all, a question. One of these right wing talk show hosts over at Town Hall wrote this whole thing about how this new member of Congress who is a Muslim, I don't have the story right in front of me, I'm forgetting his name, said that when he was sworn in, he wanted to put his hand on the Quran. And this guy, this right winger, has just gone ballistic about it, saying that's not America, that's not American value. And it seems to me that number one, according to the clerk of the House, when you're sworn in, you don't actually have to put your hand on anything. In fact, there's a photo over at Think Progress of Denny Hastert being sworn in with his hand on the podium. And secondly, you should be able to choose whatever holy book you want if you want to be sworn in with a holy book.
I agree in both instances, but what usually happens is the speaker stands up in the front of the floor, you raise your right hand, and you take the oath of office, and that's how the vast majority of the members are sworn in. Then what later on they do is they do a kind of a photo op swearing in, where the speaker will give the oath to individual members, and that's just kind of for the newspapers and stuff. But the real swearing in takes place on the floor, and there are no religious books there at all.
Interesting. So this Keith Ellison is the Democrat from Minnesota, the first Muslim elected to Congress, and God bless him. It's great to see, you know, the U.S. Congress becoming progressively more and more diverse. And this Dennis Prager, this right wing talk show host, he says this is an act that undermines American civilization. He compared it to being sworn in with a copy of Mein Kampf, if you can believe that. I mean, this is how weird the right wing is getting these days. Bernie, what's on your schedule? What do you see as the big
issue?
Well,
I think the key issue of the moment, Tom, is obviously the good news is that we have driven the Republicans out of power in both the House and the Senate. But now what we have to do, I think, as a nation is focus on a progressive agenda and demand that Congress move forward aggressively in representing the needs of middle class and working families and deal with the war in Iraq. The fact that we have new leadership in Washington means that Bush's right-wing extremism is dead. That's very, very good. But the converse is not true in the sense that it does not mean that we're going to go forward in a progressive manner unless the American people are prepared to stand up and fight and demand that Congress does that. So we have made substantial gains in the sense of stopping right-wing extremism and getting rid of the right-wing leadership in the House and the Senate. That's very, very important. But right now, the task then is to rally the forces, grassroots America, and move our country forward on issue after issue after issue in a progressive manner.
Yeah, amen. It's not enough to just vote once every 2 or 4 years.
No, it is not. And I think the culture that we have got to work on, the political culture, is politics is 365 days a year, not just 2 weeks before the election. And there is a lot of work that has to be done literally in the coming month, because the Congress, the Democratic leadership, is going to determine its priorities for the next year, next couple of years. What are they going to be? Are the American people going to be involved in that discussion? What are we going to do on trade? Very different points of view. I think the general consensus is that this election has brought forth a Congress much more suspicious and antagonistic to unfettered free trade. That's the good news. But that by no means indicates that that is going to be translated into a real trade policy which reflects the needs of American workers. What are we going to do about health care? What are we going to do about the war in Iraq? What are we going to do about constitutional rights? What are we going to do about protecting veterans, building affordable housing, dealing with child care, dealing with the huge problems facing millions and millions of working Americans who in many instances are working longer hours for lower wages? And my strong belief is that if the American people are not engaged in that discussion, are not putting pressure on the Democratic leadership, we're not going to move forward in the ways that we want to.
Bernie, one of the stories that I've been talking about throughout the week is how the dollar is falling, and you know, gold and other commodities are starting to go up. And I see this, and I'd love to get your take on this. I see this as the chickens coming home to roost. 26 years of insane, I call it conservative economics, probably voodoo economics, to use Bush Sr.'s term is better, insane policies of borrow and spend, give huge tax cuts to billionaires and millionaires and billionaires, and run up an $8.6 trillion debt, and then have on top of that an $800 billion a year trade deficit. And between the two, they have in 26 years taken America from the richest country in the world to the biggest debtor in the world.
That's right. And we have got to focus on those issues. For example, as you know, the tax rates for the wealthiest people in this country were lowered substantially. If you did nothing else but do away, rescind those tax breaks for upper income people and bring them back up to 39%, you can bring $25 billion a year more into the Treasury, some of which could be used for dealing with the record-breaking deficits that we have. Other amounts of that money can be used to address some of the very serious problems facing our country in terms of health care, in terms of educational opportunity. One of the areas that we have got to work on, I know the Democratic leadership is talking about it, I would hope that we'll go even further, is to make college education affordable to every family in America, regardless of income. Bush, as you'll recall, actually raised interest rates for middle-class families, making college education more expensive. Not only do we have to lower interest rates, in my view, we have got to significantly expand and increase the Pell Grant program to provide scholarships and grants to not only low-income families, but to middle-income families as well. We lose huge amounts of intellectual capital when we have a situation where larger and larger numbers of young people are not going to college because they don't want to come out deeply in debt or they can't afford to go to college in the first place. The country suffers when kids come out of school $30,000 or $40,000 in debt and have to choose careers based on paying back that debt rather than going to the fields that they really want to go into. So there are so many needs out there that have long been ignored by and made worse by the Republican leadership that have got to be addressed, but certainly rescinding tax breaks for the wealthiest Americans, taking a look at the capital gains reduction in taxes, the dividend reduction in taxes on dividends, as well as the personal income tax is important, because that can free up money not only to help us lower the national debt and deal with our deficits, but start addressing some of the real needs of middle-class Americans.
It seems the largest frame for all of this is the idea that Americans held from the founding of this country until Ronald Reagan essentially declared war on government and the idea of government, which is that an awful lot of what government does is not an expense but rather an investment.
Right.
From building bridges to building schools to educating our young people, and
well,
we need to bring back that concept.
Tom, what major corporation that is smart and effective and successful does not expend a huge amount of money in education and training for its workforce, right?
Yeah.
People come into a company. That company wants to make sure that those workers are as effective as they possibly can be. That's what we should be doing as a nation. We should have the strongest, best educated, most effective workforce in the entire world. Do we? We certainly do not right now. And that means making every young person in this country, regardless of the income of his or her family, understanding that if they do their schoolwork seriously, if they do well, if they have a bent for higher education and they want to go to college, they will be able to do so, no matter what their background is.
Yeah, that's the key to social mobility, and that's the American way.
That's exactly right.
It's Congressman Bernie Sanders with us, or Senator Bernie Sanders now. Brunch with Bernie on the Tom Hartman program. Our number, 866-440-8466. If you have a question or comment for Bernie, he'll be taking your calls right after the break. It's 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
I remember when this was a two-paper town. A big company came in, shut one of them down. Seems now all you get is one point of view. And it don't really matter which side you're on, 'cause nobody wins when our choices are gone. Both sides of a story often lead to the truth. Well, maybe I'm crazy, maybe it's no big deal. It's just my opinion, it's just how I feel. I dream of a world that's not all the same, where freedom is more than a word that we say, where you can say what you think and no one would dare put you down. I dream of a world that's a two-paper town.
Ah, what a fine idea. And here we are, the second paper in the radio business, the other side of the story here, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, Progressive Talk Radio, true Progressive Talk Radio, broadcasting live today from San Francisco, from the Quake, KQKE, and it's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders, Senator Bernie Sanders with us. I wonder how long it's going to take me to start saying that right, Bernie, after all these years. 23 minutes past the hour, and Bernie, let's take some phone calls, okay?
Okay.
All righty. Jim in San Francisco, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I was just wondering what the Democrats are doing to organize the Republicans to turn up they built over the last 25 years through funding, through think tanks, development. George Lakoff, in his Don't Think of an Elephant, succinctly talked about how well they framed their message, how well they marched in lockstep. And frankly, I feel sorry for Nancy Pelosi. She's trying to herd cats. And what are the Democrats doing to organize, to move the agenda we've just been speaking about forward in an organized fashion?
Well, that's a very good question. I am an independent, not a Democrat, so I'm not in the midst of all of that, but you've asked exactly the right question. And what my hope is, and let's be very clear, I think there are going to be very, very strong differences of opinion within the Democratic Party between the progressive wing and the conservative wing, those members who represent workers concerned about the environment, and those members who more or less represent the big business community, all of which is within the Democratic Party. My hope is that what progressive Democrats will do is lay out an agenda that speaks to the needs of ordinary Americans, the vast majority of the people, many of whom have given up on the political process, many of whom may have voted Democratic this election, not because they're enamored with a Democratic agenda, but they're so disgusted with what Bush and right-wing republicanism is about. But this is an opportunity for the Democratic leadership to lay out an agenda that makes sense to ordinary people. I think clearly in terms of the war right now, our position must be that we get out as soon as we possibly can. Our position also must be that we develop a progressive agenda that speaks to the needs of middle class and working families. The United States has got to join the rest of the industrialized world with a national health care program that guarantees health care to all people. We have got to have educational opportunity for all of our young people by making education affordable and significantly expanding those opportunities and those grants and scholarships that young people need. We need to break our dependency on fossil fuels. We need to move to sustainable energy. There is an enormous amount of work that can be done that speaks to the middle class, that speaks to working families. And I think the Democratic leadership has got to raise those issues and rally the American people behind them.
Yeah, and I would just add there's a number of us who are working on trying to help define the frames. I had dinner with George Lakoff last night, and I'm spending the afternoon and all day tomorrow with him at this Praxis Peace Conference here in San Francisco. And he and a group of other people. And that's the work that we're doing. And I'm, in fact, I'm working on a book right now called Cracking the Code, Decoding Political Communication. So we'll be working on that.
We have to make, I think the answer is, we have to make politics sensible and understandable to ordinary people who today feel very alienated from the political process. And at the same time, certainly a very heavy responsibility on the Democratic leadership in Congress right now is to start delivering the goods. No one thinks they're going to solve all of the problems overnight. But if we can do things like substantially raising the minimum wage, get out of Iraq as soon as we possibly can, move this country in one way or another to a national health care program, guaranteeing health care to all people, let people see, in fact, the government can work for ordinary people. Once you begin to do that, people say, oh, well, you know, maybe I should be involved in the political process. You know, I was mayor of the city of Burlington from 1981 to 1989 here in Vermont. And one of the accomplishments is that I'm most proud of is that when I won between 81 and 83, voter turnout soared because people began to see the government could respond to the needs of ordinary people. That's what we've got to do right now.
Yeah, it's rebutting the Reagan myth that government can do no wrong, do no right.
Exactly right.
Yeah. At 28 minutes past the hour, it's our Brunch with Bernie segment. We'll be back with your calls, 866-440-8466. Our number, TomHartman.com, for our live chat room. Be right back. Welcome back. 35 minutes past the hour. We're coming up on 35 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. Senator Bernie Sanders with us.
It's Senator-elect.
Senator-elect.
Technically correct.
Okay. Senator-elect.
January 4th is the swearing-in date.
Okay, good. So I have another couple weeks to get it right. We are so pleased, Bernie, that your voice is going to the Senate. Okay, we've got a board full of calls here. Let's get to it. Lynn in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening to WPTT. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hey, Bernie, Senator-elect. Bernie, you donkey riders really came in. I was going to ask you what committees you got on in the Senate.
Well, we got some good committees, and Harry Reid was very kind to me. Harry will be the president pro tem of the Senate. What I wanted to get on was the Health and Education and Labor Committee with Senator Kennedy, and I'm on that. I wanted to get on the Environmental Committee with Barbara Boxer, and I'm on that. I wanted to get on the Veterans Committee because veterans issues is something very important for Vermont and the nation, and Danny Akaka of Hawaii is the chair of that, and I'm on that one. Also, I am going to be on a couple of other committees. We're going to be on the budget committee, which I am very excited about, and we're going to be on the energy committee as well. So I got five committees, but they call 3A committees and 2B committees, and that's very good.
That is absolutely great. John in Glendora, California, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
First of all, I want to say congratulations, Senator Sanders, and it's really nice to talk to you. This is my favorite part of Tom's show every Friday. I look forward to this.
Thanks very much.
I just got a couple of quick questions, and I'll hang up and listen to your response. The first one is, as you know, Charlie Rangel came out recently and said that he's not going to eliminate the tax cuts for the rich or the poor like ourselves, but he's going to extend those. When they ran on the whole part of their campaign was they were going, you know, if you were rich, you were going to get see a tax increase. And I just wanted to know your feelings on that. And also, how would the Senate feel, or what would we need to do if we had a petition signed by all the people that, you know, if anybody, any politician wants a pay raise, has to go to a vote to the people, like when we go to our employer and we want a raise, it's based on our performance. And that's really all I wanted to say. And like I said, congratulations.
Thank you, General. Bernie, tie congressional pay raises to the minimum wage.
Well, that's one thing one could do, I guess, right? And by the way, one of the first things that I hope Congress will in fact do is raise the minimum wage. The $5.15 minimum wage is a national disgrace, and we've got to raise it to something that is substantially higher, and we've got to move toward a living wage. To my mind, and why I mentioned earlier, Tom, it is terribly important for Americans to understand that just because the Republicans were driven from power in the House and the Senate does not by any means mean that we can rest on our laurels and not be vigorously involved in the political process. To my mind, at a time when the wealthiest people in America have never had it so good and the gap between the rich and the poor is growing wider and the middle class is shrinking, I think we should rescind Bush's tax breaks to the very wealthiest people in this country. I think you should use some of that money for deficit reduction. I think other parts of that money should go to make sure that veterans in this country receive the benefits that they were promised. I think we want to make sure that college education becomes affordable for the middle class, which means not only lowering interest rates, but significantly expanding the Pell Grant and other scholarship programs. I think we can put large numbers of Americans to work building affordable housing. I think that instead of cutting Medicare and Medicaid, as the Republican leadership wants to do, we should be moving toward a national health care program which guarantees health care to all of our people. And I think the Democrats today have the momentum, not primarily because of the agenda that they have developed over the last couple of years, but because of the growing disgust that people feel about the Republican leadership and President Bush. And it is absolutely incumbent upon the Democrats, if in fact they are going to be successful, if they are going to stay in power, is speak to the needs of the shrinking middle class, of the growing level of poverty in America, of the environmental crises that we face, to be bold and stand up to the powers that be and show the American people that they are prepared to take on big money interest and move America in a very different direction. If they do not do that, if they go to bed with the wealthy and the large corporations, if they don't deal with the huge trade deficit that we have and the loss of good-paying blue-collar and white-collar information technology jobs, if they continue to see the middle class shrink and they're not vigorous in standing up, then I think their reign in power will be very short-term.
Tragically short. Lee, driving in New Mexico, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, good afternoon, Jerry. Good morning, gentlemen. Congratulations, Senator-elect. I'm calling as a person who's critically interested in the health care system. I've been a health care worker for more than 20 years. I have gone from working in community hospitals that were supported, funded, built, and directed by communities to working for corporations that are running what few hospitals remain, even in some of our major metropolitan areas. I've had to go out on my own because they couldn't pay or had cut the wages so much, I became an independent licensed contractor and began a healthcare work as an independent. I've had no health insurance that I was getting from any company. I was paying for my own at around $600 to $700 a month. I've had to let that go because my daughter's starting college, and I'm now not having health insurance so I can pay her tuition and her expenses. My question is, will we in any way be able to, ourselves, myself and other workers that I've talked to, be able to help affect this change? What can we do to bring about that change?
Well, thank you very much for your question and your comments. You're right on, to my mind. And the answer is, of course, you can have a huge impact. What we have got to tell the Democratic leadership is that the United States must join the rest of the industrialized world and move toward a national health care program that guarantees health care to every man, woman, and child. And some people say, well, that's a utopian vision. We can't do it. It's too expensive. The reality is, and Tom, you know this well, is that in America today, we spend twice as much per capita on health care as any other major country on earth, twice as much.
And we have 44 million people who don't have access.
We have 48 million people who have no health insurance, and we have even more who are underinsured, people who do have health insurance but have huge deductibles and copayments. The system needs to be fundamentally reformed, fundamentally, from the ground on up. We can provide health care to all people without spending any more than we're currently spending. But to do that, you got to take on the drug companies who charge our people by far the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs, and yet every single year at the very top of the ladder in terms of their profits. We've got to take on the insurance companies. Healthcare is a right of all people, a right of all people. And we can come up with a cost-effective, high-quality healthcare system that guarantees healthcare to all people without spending any more than we're currently spending. That's what our goal is. And we need absolutely to put pressure on the Democratic leadership in Congress to move us in that direction.
Well said. Ron, in driving in Texas. Hey, Ron, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Yes, congratulations, Senator Sanders.
Thank you, Ron.
I have a question that I've been wanting to ask, and that with Republicans in power didn't seem to go anyplace, but with you coming into your position, do you think that you may be wanting to or try to convert the concept of the war in Iraq to the occupation of Iraq? And do you think that might help in the discussion?
I mean, change the language?
Out of there?
Well, I think, however, whatever the terminology may be, Ron, I think most people understand that it is time to bring our troops home from Iraq. I don't think you can do that tomorrow, but I think we can do that certainly within the next year. I think the demand of Congress, and I certainly will be playing an active role in the Senate on this, is to get the president to have the military give him a plan to bring our troops home as soon as possible again within the next year. While we continue to support, I think we have the moral obligation to continue to support the Iraq government. I think we should have the other Arab countries involved in that process. I think we should have the international community do whatever we can to bring stability into Iraq. But poll after poll after poll indicates that the Iraqi people themselves want the American troops out of Iraq. I think we should listen to those people. I think we should bring our troops home as soon as we can. What we're doing there now in many ways is simply counterproductive, inflaming the insurgency, and I will be working hard to bring our troops home as soon as we possibly can.
Yeah, well said. Al in Merritt Island, Florida. Hey, Al, we just have a few seconds for a quick question, and then maybe Bernie can answer it after the break.
For 6 years, the Republicans have said in the Senate that Democrats have obstructed getting laws passed. Can you tell me when they, since they were the majority in the Senate without filibustering, how can they obstruct it?
Well, I don't think the Democrats have what you need is, in some respects, you can filibuster and you can, you need 60 votes to get something passed. But, I think right now the ball is in the Democratic leadership's hand. It's not going to be easy. I think they've got to go out to the American people, come up with a progressive agenda, and let's fight to pass that.
Well said. 46 minutes past the hour. Coming up on 46 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman program, Brunch with Bernie, Congressman Senator-elect Bernie Sanders with us. We'll be right back.
I love leaves in the wind, pictures of my friends, birds of the world, and squirrels. I love coffee in a cup, little fuzzy pups, old TV shows, and snow.
And welcome back. And I love doing radio, and I'm so thankful that Bernie Sanders is with us. Bernie Sanders, the longest-serving independent member of the House of Representatives, now an independent member of the United States Senate. I always think of him as America's congressman and now America's senator because not beholden to either party and just doing absolutely marvelous work.
Well, thank you very much. Those accolades, Tom. I'll send you the money later.
Yeah. Don't forget the tip, Bernie. 1-866-440-8466, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Kenny in Baltimore, Maryland, you are live with Bernie Sanders.
Hey, I run a business. I run my own business, and I do most of my own accounting work. From looking at all the numbers and not really looking at their books, I can tell that the government numbers is like completely off. My question to you, Bernie, is can you or can anybody in Democrats force to get the true numbers on the economy, the true numbers on these programs, and do this by true accounting laws? Because if you don't get that, all the stuff you want to do will go for naught, because it'll end up like Enron.
Well, that's a good point, Kenny. I think, you know, we got to know what reality is before we can go forward. I tend to agree with your concerns. We certainly know that our country is running year after year a deep deficit, that we have over an $8 trillion national debt. But some of the things, to answer Kenny's question, that we don't do a particularly good job about, Tom, is I think really understanding what is going on in our economy.
Yeah.
My gut feeling is, and I think it's worse than the official statistics are telling us, is that the middle class in America today is in probably worse shape than the official position indicates.
Well, they've reconfigured two or three times now how they count an unemployed person, and now I think if you're employed 1 hour a week or something,
there you go. Right. So, I mean, for all intents and purposes, yeah, you have somebody who really is unemployed or underemployed, and yet they will be listed as being employed. The other statistics that we don't get a good enough handle on is not only the level of poverty in America and the decline of the middle class, but the growing gap between the rich and the poor. We have the most unequal distribution of wealth and income of any major country on earth by far, and it's time that we began to talk about that, because the more we get that information out, I think the better people will understand the absurdity of giving tax breaks to billionaires and millionaires while we cut back on the needs of middle class and working families. So I think there is a lot to be delved into and a lot to be discussed with the American people. But I think that Kenny is right. We need to get that information out.
Amen. Dwayne in San Francisco, you're listening on The Quake. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hello.
Hey, Dwayne.
Oh, I'm sorry, Tom. I didn't. Senator Sanders, People's Lobby recently initiated citizen-initiated legislation, which Tom is a little aware of. We sent it to your office, to your legislative director. It's called the American World Service Corps Bill. It would ramp up over 7 years and put 1 million Americans into voluntarily serving in their choice of the Peace Corps, AmeriCorps, Habitat for Humanity, Doctors Without Borders, Head Start, Red Cross, International Rescue Committee, Oxfam, Mercy Corps, etc. And if you did the service, at the conclusion of the service, a young person, the attraction is they get 2 years of community college plus 2 years of state college tuition. And we're also trying to attract middle-aged people, baby boomers and retirees. We think it's the way to address both Iraq and the public policymaking.
So is this like a domestic Peace Corps of sorts?
Well, it bolsters the Peace Corps, AmeriCorps, Head Start, Habitat. It's an umbrella agency, a small organization that sends America's best resources, our citizens, to do service in those organizations by giving them 1 million more Americans to do that kind of voluntary service. And that, you know, not only does it win hearts and minds and nation builds at home or abroad, because in this they have their choice. They could serve rebuilding Katrina. You'd have more Head Start workers, more Habitat workers, more AmeriCorps workers in those areas that were affected by disasters. But at the same time, you could send them to Pakistan to do the kind of things the 13 medics from New York did. And that way, we get a real education in the classroom of the world's needs. And then when they come back, we reward them with educational incentives. Or if you're a baby boomer, you put that cash equivalent in your medical savings or your IRA account. Yeah, I've sent that to your legislative.
Dwayne, that is a very exciting idea, and thanks for the work that you are doing. Number one is, I gather at the end of the day, the payment will be 2 years of college. Is that what you're saying?
I'm sorry, I dropped Dwayne.
Yeah, I think that's what Dwayne was saying. And,
He said 2 years at community college and then 2 years at a state university.
Well, I think those are the kind of ideas we need to take a hard look at. They address putting people to work, addressing the real problems facing their fellow Americans and people throughout the world. And certainly with the high cost of college education, we've got to come up with ways that we can help people get the education that they need. So it's a very good idea.
Jack Kennedy with the Peace Corps just did amazing things for America's image around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And for a whole generation of Americans who had an opportunity to serve. I mean, it's just...
No, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. So it's an interesting idea. Well, we have to wrap up the hour, but Bernie Sanders, Senator-elect Bernie Sanders, thanks again so much for being with us.
All right, my pleasure, Tom.
Always great having you on. Senator Bernie Sanders, bernie/house.gov, is that...
It still is, but we'll be changing the website pretty soon.
Okay, great. All right.
Take care. Bye.
Thanks a lot, Bernie. 58 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio. 56 minutes past the hour. I've got a couple of clocks here. Now 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman Radio Program. Our phone number, 1-866-440-8466. It's Friday. We'll be taking your calls on a wide variety of topics, whatever you'd like to talk about. And we've got news and other interesting things coming up. Stick around. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Larry Pratt is with us. He's the executive director of Gun Owners of America, gunowners.org, the website. And Larry, I understand you're very concerned about the Democrats coming into power.
Well, Tom, that is our read. We see the Republicans as having been rather disappointing in their performance. They came into power, and President Clinton had even lamented more than once publicly that it was the gun issue that had cost the Democrats control of the Congress. And the Republicans then proceeded to behave as if the issue didn't really matter and did very little. And their committee chairman, you just have to say, we're not that philosophically committed to the issues of the Republican base. But I don't see that being the case with the change over to the Democrats' control of Congress now, because you have people Mr. Conyers of Michigan. This is somebody who's going to head up the Judiciary Committee, and he's a very staunch opponent of people owning and carrying firearms. And so I think we're going to see a lot of action in this regard. We're going to see bills that we were able to stop sometimes, but barely, in committee. Well, they're not going to stop in committee. They're going to go right on out to the floor.
Yeah, well, Larry, first of all, I may be wrong, but I believe that John Conyers' position is not that he's opposed to people owning firearms. He's opposed to people owning firearms unlicensed, just like we don't allow people to drive cars unlicensed.
Well, his voting record speaks a lot more clearly to being willing to ban guns as well.
Yeah. Here's the Democratic National Platform from 2004, which is still the official Democratic Party's position on guns and gun control, is quite straightforward. It's one sentence. And all the Democrats basically have to salute this. I mean, this is the official Democratic position. I quote, "We will protect Americans' Second Amendment right to own firearms, and we will keep guns out of the hands of criminals and terrorists, by fighting gun crime, reauthorizing the assault weapons ban, and closing the gun show loophole, as President Bush proposed and failed to do." Now, these are all positions, reauthorizing the assault weapons ban, closing the gun show loophole. I mean, that's it. That's all that they're suggesting to do. That President Bush actually can't.
Well, there's another statement in there that gives even more wiggle room, and that's the so-called keeping guns out of the wrong hands. That's certainly not.
No, they say by fighting gun crime. You know, in other words, increasing penalties for people who commit crimes while they're using guns.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what do you object to in this?
Well, the fact that gun control of any stripe has not been successful. You don't find jurisdictions that have banned guns enjoying a better crime rate. In fact, Washington, D.C., which has banned guns almost completely. You can have a shotgun, but it has to be at home and has to be in a safe and it has to be disarmed, unable to be used.
Well, it's hard to find any place in Washington, D.C. where you're going to go hunting.
Well, if you're going to use the gun, obviously you would, under the laws, have to leave the city. There's no place, there's no gun range, there's nothing. There used to be gun ranges in the schools, but and some of those ranges are still there, they're just not in use. So what Washington has gotten for its trouble is a murder rate of 45 per 100,000.
But that's because they're contiguous. I mean, Washington is a little tiny community, basically, that is surrounded by two states that have much looser gun laws. And people are, you know, it's easy just to, you know, you drive 10 minutes and you can go buy a gun. You can go to a gun show and not even have to show ID, not have to do anything.
Well, actually, you don't have to leave the city to buy a gun. But what happens is that.
But you get my point.
In Northern Virginia, in Fairfax County, where Gun Owners of America is located, right outside the Beltway, we have a murder rate of less than 1 per 100,000, and yet guns are legal, available, people can carry them openly anywhere, they can get a concealed carry permit quite easily. So it would seem to me that if the problem for Washington is the guns coming from the surrounding states, why isn't the murder rate and the violent crime rate much higher in those areas than it is even in Washington, where the guns are illegal?
Well, I think we can both agree that the problem is not just the availability of guns. We have societal problems. When you have people in poverty and you have, you know, systems that are not working, economic systems that are not working, and the, you know, people who want to be entrepreneurs, and the only kind of business they can start is, for example, selling drugs. Because there really are no other entrepreneurial opportunities available to them.
Well, Fairfax County isn't free of the drug problem. It seems to be a scourge everywhere in the country.
Yeah. No, but
it's an urban county. It has all of the demographics of Washington, D.C., basically. Mm-hmm. And actually, an even closer comparison would be that of Arlington, Virginia, which is in every way like Washington, D.C., except it's even a little bit smaller.
But I'm just curious why you oppose reauthorize, you know, why do you think that people should be allowed to own assault weapons?
Well, first of all, I think that word connotes machine guns, and that's not what we're talking about.
Don't have any problem with restrictions on machine guns?
I do, but that's not what we're talking about. The assault weapon, so-called, is a semi-automatic rifle that usually has been painted black or something. It was not before the ban used in any significant amount of crime and murder. The New York State Police had found in the run-up to the national ban study that they did that you were 11 times more likely to be killed by somebody using their hands and feet than you were by somebody with one of these semi-automatic firearms. They weren't a problem before the ban. They weren't a problem during the ban. They're not a problem
after
the ban.
Well, I can say, you know, you're 50,000 times more likely to be killed by lightning than by a terrorist in the United States. That still doesn't mean that the United States should ignore terrorism. I mean, you know, throw.
Well, it means that you shouldn't ban something that's a lot less of a problem than swimming pools and cars.
But what possible reason other than the profits of the industry that makes these things, which heavily funds the NRA? Other than the profits of that industry, what possible reason? I mean, I'm not going to go hunting with a semi-automatic or an automatic weapon.
Well, actually, you could go hunting with a semi-automatic.
Let's talk about automatic weapons.
Automatic weapon, you'd have to, I would think, keep it on single-shot mode. But the reason you would have one of these firearms is precisely what happened in Los Angeles when the famous pictures of the Korean merchants defending their places of business, one of the few places that didn't burn in whole neighborhoods, because they had these kinds of firearms.
Taking the position that if we all had guns, that we'd have a more polite, you know, an armed society is a polite society? The Wild West is a good thing?
That certainly is the case when you compare jurisdictions where they have very tight gun control or bans versus those where guns are more readily available.
So if we're going to allow Americans to be heavily armed with automatic weapons, shouldn't we at the very least say, hey, if we're going to require some level of a demonstration of level of competence and intelligence to drive an automobile, because it can be a dangerous weapon and it can kill people. We're going to require a demonstration of a level of competence, we'll leave it at that, to own a weapon.
I think taking driving lessons is an extremely good idea, and I think learning how to use a gun is an extremely good idea. But the government-mandated requirements for driving hasn't kept cars from being used in more deaths than our firearms.
I would argue that it has kept a lot of people, has made our highways as safe as they can be. I mean, are you suggesting that we shouldn't require driver's ed before a 16-year-old gets in a car?
I think Americans are more responsible than many people think and want to have the government directing all of these different aspects of people's lives. People understand that automobiles and firearms are potentially very dangerous.
You and I have both been through firearms training. I mean, I've been through firearms training at the Georgia Police Academy. I've been through firearms training at a local gun range. With the NRA. I'm sure you have. What's wrong with saying that you have to have some sort of a certification before you can own a firearm?
Well, you end up with a system such as that of New York City, where only the good friends of those who are politically influential are able to get permits. People like Cyrus Sulzberger has had for years a concealed carry permit in New York City, even though toward the end of that time he didn't even have residence in New York City, but they let him keep it anyway. You can make the requirements so difficult that, in effect, you've got a ban. And that's why we don't like to see the government doing something where, in fact, you can't demonstrate that the government's involvement produces a better result.
And yet we have an epidemic. I mean, in Canada, on a per capita basis, there are more guns per capita than there are in the United States.
No, that's not correct. That's just simply not correct.
There's a lot of guns in Canada.
They have a number of guns, but mostly hunting rifles. Very difficult to get a handgun in Canada.
And the murder rate is very, very low in Canada. Doesn't that tell you something?
Well, the murder rate has been rising, and their gun registry has been totally useless, and it's one of the reasons why their liberal government fell and the conservatives were able to get into power.
The conservatives in Canada are not proposing liberalizing the gun laws there.
The conservatives of Canada are working right now to get rid of the long gun registry. The handgun registry has been in effect since 1934. It's never been used to solve a crime. Never.
Interesting. Larry Pratt, gunowners.org, the website.
Good to be with you, Tom.
A debate that I'm sure will continue. Thanks for being with us, Larry.
Yeah, my pleasure.
16 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman radio program. Our number, 1-866-440-8466. Drop by our live chat room at TomHartman.com, and we'll be right back.
Hallelujah, dads and mommies, cowboys, rebels, yanks, and commies. Buy yourself some real red-blooded fun. If you want to make the grade, you've got to have a hand grenade and a fully automatic GI gun. So buy a gun for your son right away, sir. Shake his hand like a man and let him play, sir. Let his little mind expand. Place a weapon in his hand, for the skills he learns today will someday pay, sir. Pound that kid into submission till he's mastered nuclear fission. Buy him plastic warheads by the score. Once he's got the taste of blood, he's gonna sneak up on his buddies, starting his own thermonuclear war. So buy a gun for your son.
Welcome back. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from San Francisco today at the Quake. Crime, that old menace of the old New Orleans, is back. This in the front page of today's USA Today. And it's bedeviling a city trying to recover from Hurricane Katrina. There have been 147 people killed in New Orleans this year, police say. Down from 204 by this time in 2005, but still way up from pre-Katrina. This, whether or not there are guns. In fact, they opened the story with the story of this woman who was killed and dismembered by her boyfriend, who then committed suicide. And, rather tragic story. But what it points out is that the failure, I think it's kind of secondary to the whole issue of gun control, the failure of civil society, the failure of government to govern, the right-wing idea, the idea held by the Bush administration, that if you just let private industry handle everything, everything will be just fine. You know, Ronald Reagan's famous, you know, I've always thought the nine most scary words and the terrifying words in the English language were, I'm from the government, I'm here to help. Yeah. And but in the absence of government, what you end up with is Baghdad. What you end up with is New Orleans. And the Bushies said, oh, yeah, we'll throw some Blackwater guys at them, and they'll walk around with their, you know, big assault weapons for a while, and then we'll just get out of there and leave them to their own devices. And it's not working. Because the infrastructure of society has been so badly damaged in New Orleans, society itself is starting to melt down. And I really think that anytime we discuss the gun issue, we also need to discuss the societal meltdown issue. Because there is a connection between the use of weapons and, you know, guns and, you know, in murder and other things like that, and the destruction of civic society that has been ongoing for the last 26 years, ever since Reagan first declared war on the idea of government, on the idea of we helping out ourselves, on the idea of we working together as a community. And also at the same time, there's this whole issue of, you know, is an armed society a polite society? I just respectfully disagree on that. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Janice in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Janice, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Well, I wish that fellow was still on because I'm moving to Canada, and I have friends up there, and I've followed not as closely their politics as ours, but the conservative government did not fall because of the gun ownership issue.
You mean the Liberal government, yeah.
I'm sorry, yes, the Liberal government. Because that was just the Liberals being in power too long, getting complacent. And it was really the NDP that brought it down, and they're the very, very Liberal side of the government.
Right.
And the NDP actually gained seats in that election. The Conservatives didn't win a clear majority. This was just a wake-up call for the Liberal government.
Right. For Americans to understand this, probably another way to put it in context would be, a metaphor or analogy would be, if in the United States the Green Party picked up enough seats that the Democrats, you know, lost that many seats, that the Democrats lost power, and now you've got, you know, the Greens and the Republicans having the majority of seats because that's, you know, or progressive Democrats. See, we only have two parties here. They have multiple parties there, but by and large, two parties in Canada, because they do have first-past-the-post, winner-take-all elections. But nonetheless, that what it demonstrates is the viability and importance of progressive politicians and progressive politics, and how these kind of mainstream, you know, liberals in Canada, Democrats in America, who are trying to, quote, be the middle, when in fact they're being the right, doesn't work.
Right.
Doesn't work politically.
Right.
So you were talking about their positions on gun ownership.
Yeah, and that just like here, their conservatives have the same position on gun ownership, and that's just part of their platform. That's not why they won.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, I hope the NDP continues to grow up there.
There you go. Which is the progressive branch of the Liberal movement, as it were, in Canada.
Right.
Right. I don't recall what NDP stands for. Do you?
New Democratic Party.
Thank you very much.
Okay. You have a great day.
Thanks. Okay. Great to hear from you.
Bye. Yes. Bye.
Good talking with you. Jimmy in Sacramento, California. Hey, Jimmy, we just have a few seconds here.
Good morning. I just wanted to respectfully disagree a little bit. In the colonies, the militias had individuals took their own personal weapons home, as opposed to crew-served weapons like cannon that were in armories.
Right, Jimmy. Can you hold on? Let's.
Yeah.
I'd like to discuss this a little more with you, and I appreciate the call. We'll be right back. 28 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman program. 866-440-8466. Our telephone number, TomHartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, we'll be right back.
Nobody checks. I'm a Republican now. We still ain't having no sex. I'm holier than thou. I'm a Republican.
That's all it takes. 35 minutes past the hour. 34 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here on listener-supported radio, supported by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors. Please support the sponsors you hear on our local radio stations, particularly the local sponsors. They're the ones who are out there really working on a local basis to gain your support and your loyalty, your purchases, and our national sponsors as well, like Sacred Grounds Coffee, sacredgroundscoffee.com, 1-800-425-2532, all fair trade, all organic. Small Dog Electronics, the place for all things Macintosh, all things computer, really. They're Mac specialists, though. 1-800-511-MAX, get the latest iPods now. And the Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE, or ecowine.com, their website, 1-888-ECOWINE. 1-866-440-8466. Just a second ago, we were talking with Jimmy in Sacramento. Hey. So, Jimmy, the point you were making.
Okay, my point was that maybe there should be more of a distinction, not necessarily between semi-automatic and automatic weapons, but between individual weapons and crew-served weapons. Now,
what's crew-served mean?
Well, like cannon. Or maybe a heavy machine gun with a tripod.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is the thing to keep in mind, is that the Second Amendment came about as the result of a debate that Thomas Jefferson started when Madison first sent him the Constitution in 1787. Jefferson was in France, and he said that he wanted a Bill of Rights. He would prevent Virginia from signing the Constitution, and he did for 2 years, unless there was a Bill of Rights attached to it. And that Bill of Rights, in his mind, had to include a ban on standing armies. He wanted to have a Swiss-style militia where every able-bodied man between the ages of 17 and 47 in every locality all across the United States had a gun in the closet and was a member of, and knew how to use it, was a member of a local militia. And there was no army during times of peace, so there would be nobody, no military-industrial complex, and nobody who, like Musharraf, could rise up and overthrow a democratically elected government like the dictator of Pakistan did.
And I absolutely agree.
Yeah.
I think that would have been...
Jefferson was right. You know, yeah, I agree. And so he put forward this proposal that every person, that in order to maintain a well-regulated militia, that everybody should have the right to own a gun, and that there should be no standing army during time of peace. And it got hashed out and fought over and by essentially one vote. I mean, it actually got written into the Constitution of Pennsylvania, and it was there for a while. It was taken out later on. But by one vote, as I recall, this failed to pass into being part of the Second Amendment. Jefferson failed. And, you know, he kept thinking he could do it. When he became president, he started whacking away at the army and cutting it down to about 3,000 people by the time he left office. But the Second Amendment does not say you have the right to ordnance, you have the right to a cannon, right. You have the right to an aircraft carrier, you have the right to and it's not about having a citizen militia to fight back the United States government, as some folks on the right seem to think. It's about having a citizen...
I read The Federalist, and I recall one of Alexander Hamilton's, one of his letters that he wrote for that suggested that the difference between America and Europe was that Americans had their own guns at home, and governments controlled by the divine right of kings denied their citizens the right to be armed.
You may well be right. I don't recall having read that. I think I probably would have. I have read the Federalist Papers. I thought I would have caught that, but you may be right. But in
any
case,
I don't remember the exact reference.
But at that point, at the time that Hamilton was writing the Federalist Papers, Hamilton and Madison and John Jay to some extent, that was 1787, and the Bill of Rights was not attached until 1789, as I recall, or maybe even a year later, 1790. So he wasn't referring to the Second Amendment in any case, if he said that.
And I also wanted to closely define assault weapon. Yeah. Now, technically, an assault weapon is a paramilitary-type firearm, usually selective fire, can semi- or fully auto, chambered for an intermediate-sized cartridge, a cartridge that's less powerful than a full-power rifle cartridge. In other words, the M1 Garand and the M1A or M14 were full-power battle rifles, whereas the M16 and the AK are assault rifles.
Yeah. So therefore, we should define these separately, and you have no reason, no justifiable reason to own an assault weapon, but you do to have a hunting weapon or a concealed weapon for self-defense.
Mm.
Is that what you're suggesting?
I would suggest that there is reason to have a battle rifle. I do believe.
What would the reason be?
That the Second Amendment, partly exists, that citizens can take back the government if it shows authoritarianism.
Not a chance. Not a chance. I mean, you know, look at any of the protests. I mean, you know, from Kent State forward, look at any of the protests. The government of the United States is so heavily armed, and we don't just arm ourselves. I mean, we're the largest arms dealer to the world.
Yeah.
There's no way that the citizens would have a chance to take on this government militarily. We have to do it politically. And to try to do so militarily, I mean, that was David Koresh's dream, you know, and look at where it got him. Respectfully disagree, but anyhow, I got to move along. We got a bunch of other callers on the topic. Jimmy,
right.
thanks for your call and your thoughtful perspective. I appreciate it. Bob in Vancouver, BC. Hey, Bob, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
I have to say I've truly enjoyed your program. I listened to it on through the internet as well. I can't understand how you folks can allow more people to be killed by gunfire through citizenry than in 5 years than died in Vietnam.
Yeah.
And
I don't understand it either, Bob. I mean, you know, I don't think any Americans understand. This is the question that Michael Moore raised in his movie Bowling for Columbine. You know, why is it that Americans are so A, in love with guns, and B, so willing to kill each other with guns, and Canadians, for example, aren't?
It's beyond thought, but many of the things that are happening within your government in the last few years have a lot of us very concerned. Being in the continental bed that we are with the elephant, and we wonder when our oil and our water will be your next target.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a good question. Yeah, you've got more oil than Iraq, so are you guys next?
an awful lot of water that you folks need.
Yeah, so. Yeah. But there are a lot of guns in Canada, and Canadians don't kill each other the way Americans do. What are your thoughts on why? My take on why is that the Canadian government is actually more effective and more efficient at governing. You have more of a civil society in Canada because the government is more what the righties would call socialist, what I would call, you know, activist or liberal or progressive. And as a consequence of that, you don't have the horrifyingly deep problems of poverty and crime that we have in the United States, where we have, you know, these incredible numbers of our civilians in prison. And you know, these crazy drug laws and just, you know, this hyper-militarized or policeized reaction to pretty much everything in the United States. I think that that's part of what's driving this, not to mention the death penalty, you know, brutalizing our people.
Well, my opinion is that we did not begin our nation through warfare.
Hmm.
And every nation that...
Actually, you did. I mean, Canada was begun by warfare against the Native Americans in Canada.
That's inaccurate. We did it mostly by deceptive treaties.
I see.
And illness.
Okay. All right. Well, and in fact, that's how probably much of America was taken as well. You're right.
For the initial 50 years of our government, the French, the English, and the natives had to agree. Now, the Caucasians took over and relegated the natives to reservations, and I think that's an indictment.
Sure.
For our government.
Yeah. But I mean, you did have a war. I mean, you'll recall in 1812, you marched on Washington, D.C. and burned the White House.
Well, yes, but that was in response to one of your generals saying it's just a matter of marching into Canada to take over.
Uh-huh.
And
so the Canadian story of the War of 1812 is that it was a defensive first strike, sort of like Bush's Iraqi adventure?
Well, I don't believe that we did the first strike. I believe the Americans did the first strike. We have been invaded by America five times.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, on two occasions, we lost some of the land, one being Maine and the other being the San Juan Islands. But the other occasions, we repelled fairly well.
Yeah. Interesting.
Bob,
we need to teach Canadian history in the United States, you know?
I found that American history is fairly an interesting thing to read because international history seems to be somewhat different.
Yeah, indeed. Bob, thanks for the call, and thanks for listening to us there in Vancouver. We'll be back with your calls on this topic. Should we... It just makes sense that we would just license people who are going to own weapons and that we wouldn't allow weapons, basically military weapons, to be running around loose in our country. It just seems to make sense to me. 46 minutes past the hour.
Liar, liar, you've been found out. Whistleblowers, they talk about how you classify and you cook the books. For the benefit of a bunch of crooks. Liar, liar, pants on fire.
The official George W. Bush song. Welcome back, 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where our talking points come from, Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. Sleeping Giant over in the chat room says, did your guests say that the conservatives won the election in Canada because of the gun registry? They won because of a sponsorship scandal that was giving money to ad agencies in Quebec to promote unity. The gun registry had little or nothing to do with the outcome of the election. These folks will use any reason to validate their views. Thank you for that. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Gerhard, San Francisco, California. California on the line, listening on the Quake. Hey, Gerhard.
Oh, good morning, or good afternoon, depending on where you're at.
Yeah, all of the above. You and I are in San Francisco right now, so it's morning, but yeah.
Let's see if you can tell me who made this famous quote. For the first time in history, a civilized nation has full gun registration. Our streets will be safer, our police more efficient, and the world will follow our lead into the future. Who made that quote?
Well, I understand that it's been attributed to Hitler by a number
correct.
Of sites.
Ding, 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 ding. Bingo, win.
But just, you know, I can give you a lot of quotes from Hitler if you want that may seem to present or argue against a whole bunch of different things.
The point to that is that gun control is instrumental to fascism. Look at Cuba, which is a fascist society. A uniparty fascist
Cuba
dictatorship.
Is a communist society, not a fascist society.
Same thing, dude.
No, it's not the same thing. A fascist society is where corporations, private enterprise and private wealth primarily run the government. And a communist society is one
definition.
Where...
You're giving me the definition.
I'm giving you the definition out of the dictionary.
Cuba is a fascist society.
No,
just
Cuba
like
is
Soviet
a
Russia,
communist society,
like
and I condemn
Nazi
it just as aggressively
Germany.
As you do.
Dude, please, just like Nazi Germany, just like Soviet Russia, and pretty much just like Massachusetts, too,
yeah.
Where you're not allowed to own a gun if you walk into a police
station. So we should all have MAC-10s, Garrett.
Pardon me?
We should all be walking around with automatic weapons on our hip.
Not automatic, but a semi-automatic.
So you're opposed to people owning automatic weapons.
Back in the days when you could walk around with a revolver in your pocket, this was a far safer country. Well, now only criminals walk around with revolvers in their pockets. Because
and you think
the
good
people are not allowed, even though the Constitution says we can.
Thank you very much for the call, but concatenating cliches. Is not furthering a reasonable discourse, I don't think, here. Milton in Ketchikan, Alaska. Hey, Milton.
Yes. Hi, Tom. I happen to be a very avid
listener of yours, and I happen to be, I hope, very progressive. But I did want to correct you on one thing. First off, we accuse those on the right-wing radio of many times making misstatements that scare their constituency into, believing certain things and then taking action on them. When you were talking to that gentleman about assault weapons and lifting the assault weapon ban, I heard the referral, I think, both from you and you having him describe the weapons, that you used the term machine gun and that there was on many times that the current assault weapons were implied as having either burst fire or fully automatic capability. The assault weapons that are currently allowed only allow one shot per trigger pull.
Right, but you can pull the trigger awful fast.
Yeah, you can pull the trigger awful fast. Very few people can keep the gun pointed in the same direction when they pull it fast, but
well, it depends. I've fired Uzis and semi-automatic, and I've fired
virtually every semi-automatic weapon there is. But I just wanted to clarify that little distinction of implying that they're machine guns is a mischaracterization.
Point taken.
Possibly a little misleading and can be scary.
Yeah.
When assault weapons are scary enough as it is.
Yeah, we're not talking about Thompsons here, but I would suggest to you that a good old fashioned Thompson machine gun, which I've fired also, is frankly less scary to a civilized society than some of these new like the MAC-10, I believe it is.
The MAC-10, yeah, shoots the same bullet.
Yeah, you're firing, those are 9mm rounds, aren't they?
45s.
Okay, yeah, which will do an awful lot of damage and fire them very, very fast.
A tremendous amount. The difference is that Thompson is much more accurate.
Yeah, but it's much bigger and it's harder to carry around.
Because I'm not really into guns as much as I am into studying social issues. I'm just saying that, to just characterize it,
characterizing
them as automatic weapons, it seems like we have allowed our people to carry around automatic weapons when, in fact, they are not automatic.
Got your point, Milton. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Matt in Auburn, Washington. Hey, Matt.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Good. What's up?
Good, yeah, I saw you in Seattle.
Hey, Matt, I'm sorry. I
love your show.
Thank you. I don't have my normal clock in front of me, and so I missed that cue. Let me put you on hold. We'll pick you up on the other side of the hour here at the top, if you can stick around, okay?
Okay.
Great. Thank you very much. 57 minutes past the hour, coming up on the top of this hour. By the way, are George W. Bush lovers certifiably crazy? An amazing news story coming out of Southern Connecticut State University indicates that those who support Bush may be, mentally ill. Strange. We'll talk about that. And we'll be back with Matt's call and you and the rest of you here right after this. 58 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Program.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. And radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 7 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. House conservatives push fringe abortion measure instead of vital budget bills. The headline over at thinkprogress.org. Yes, indeed. Next week, the 109th Congress returns for a final lame duck session. What are the Republicans up to? Well, In a blend of peak and laziness, conservatives are choosing to simply ignore their responsibility to complete 9 overdue spending bills. Instead, they're going to be promoting a fetal pain abortion bill. No chance of passing. This is just, you know, last bid for loyalty to the base of social conservatives. Chris Smith, a Republican from New Jersey. Social Security Administration has told congressional staff it may have to furlough every employee. HUD funding is not keeping pace with demand for low-income housing vouchers, meaning literally thousands of people will be out on the street. School breakfast and lunch programs face a $1 billion shortfall, cutting off 1.2 million participants. The Veterans Health Administration have to absorb $3 billion increase to meet this year's requirements. The Republicans, they're not even talking about these issues. They're going to talk about whether fetuses feel pain. That's going to be their argument. Meanwhile, the Bush administration is now quantifying you and me for the first time in the history of the United States. Absolutely unindicted, non-suspicious. I mean, you're just average people, you and me. This is called the automated tracking system. The Department of Homeland Security has put this thing together. They're claiming sweeping exemptions from the Privacy Act of 1974. The ACLU, all upset about this. Here's the press release, in fact, from the ACLU. The American Civil Liberties Union today condemned an unprecedented new program. See, this is Big Brother, I'm telling you, for generating terrorist ratings on tens of millions of American citizens. Primarily people who travel. You go through an airport, bingo! Maintaining these ratings for 40 years and making them available throughout the government. Never before in American history, says Barry Steinhardt, director of the ACLU's Technology and Liberty Project. Never before in American history has our government gotten into the business of creating mass risk assessment ratings of its own citizens. This is a radical new step with far-reaching implications, but one that has been taken almost thoughtlessly by expanding a cargo tracking system to incorporate human beings and with little public notice, discussion, or debate. He says innocent people are going to get caught up in this program, and they will have precious little recourse under it. When some unknown government computer using unknown sources of information tags you as a security risk and begins circulating that label around the government, you will have no meaningful way of finding out why you were given the label, let alone challenging its validity. They're going to freeze your checking account. They're going to start looking at it. They're going to start tapping your phones. They're going to start following you. And you get to say, hey, why? And they get to say, we don't have to tell you. We're Republicans. I mean, we were having the argument with the caller a little earlier about what's the definition of the fascist. I think that we're getting there. This whole mentality that the only way to control people is by threats of violence and that you have to have the iron fist. This is the Republican worldview. This is the terrified worldview. Actually, there's some Republicans who are opposed to this as well. And there's some Democrats, no doubt, who support it. This is the conservative worldview, let's say. Going all the way back to Thomas Hobbes, I mean, in the 18th century. And that conservative worldview, you know, that humans are inherently evil and that we need to bring the force of government to bear in every way on us and on our lives. I'm sorry, I reject it. Matt in Auburn, Washington. Matt, we were talking just before the break at the top of the hour for the news, and you were about to make a point. Welcome.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Good.
Can you hear me okay?
I can, yeah.
Just fine. Okay.
Just fine. What's up?
Hey, I just wanted to say I saw you. I love your show. I saw you in Seattle a few weeks ago, and I thought you were great.
Thank you.
And I just wanted to say I am a socialist, and I'm also a member of Gun Owners of America.
Mm-hmm.
I heard Larry Pratt speaking a little bit ago.
Yeah.
And a lot of people think that that's an oxymoron. You know, I get it from both the left and the right criticizing me when I tell them I believe in, you know, two things that seem to be diametrically opposite.
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, I don't own a gun, but I certainly know how to shoot one. My brother owns a couple of guns, and his partner owns several guns, and has a carry permit. And we go to Michigan, and for fun, we go to the rifle range. I mean, it doesn't mean that you can't be progressive in your politics. On the other hand, we all, I think, have to acknowledge that we have a problem here in the United States.
We do, and I wanted to just touch on that very, very briefly. You mentioned there is a lack of a civil society in the United States.
Yeah, this is,
and
this
I agree
is,
with
this
that.
Is my
and
point.
I think
is that,
the problem, I mean, when you spoke in Seattle a few weeks ago, you spoke a lot about class. And I think, like you, I mean, me, you know, being a progressive socialist, that class is a very, very real thing in this country.
Yes.
And the reason why I tend to be opposed to most gun control is Larry Pratt touched on this when he was on your show earlier. Wealthy people or the politically well-connected will always find a way to buy guns, buy permits, or hire armed security.
And so will criminals.
Class is a very real thing, and it determines whether or not a person can own a gun. And we're talking about armed insurrection and all this, but I think we need to think much more at a micro level and talk about crime.
Yeah.
Crime is caused by poverty, it's caused by unemployment, and it's caused by hopelessness.
Yes.
When a crime is about, you know, when the police...
And let me just toss in here, if I may, Matt. The conservatives
sure.
will say, no, wait a minute. You know, we've got criminals that are, you know, multi-generational and, you know, ethnically defined and blah, blah. And you know, the easy answer to that is go back and read your American history about the late 19th and early 20th century when the main
right.
criminals in the United States, in quotes, were the Italians and the Irish. You know, the immigrant societies and the highest crime rates were in those neighborhoods, and they were viewed by and labeled as many Americans as being some sort of, you know, underclass, or, you know, there's something genetically wrong with these people. They're so violent, you
sure.
know, and it wasn't. It was they were the subject. They were the victims of discrimination in the United States by basically WASPs. Who were, you know, Anglophiles who were saying, you know, no, we're going to keep you in to the Italians and to the Irish, going to keep you in lower, to use your word, class, to keep, you know, to push you down. And what do you do when you don't have economic options? What do you do when you don't have, you turn to crime?
I absolutely agree. And the bottom line is we can talk about these underlying causes, you know, things that cause crime, but the police, generally speaking, cannot prevent crime from occurring. They can only respond to crime after it happens.
To a large
and
extent.
I just see, you know, gun control is commonly understood. That would disarm poor and working class people and leave them much more vulnerable to criminal activity than wealthy people.
Yeah, but the fact of the matter is, I mean, you look at the stats, and you have to know this, Matt. You look at the stats, and for every person who successfully wards off a criminal with a gun, there's between 9 and 10 people who accidentally kill themselves or intentionally kill themselves with a gun who probably wouldn't have if they didn't have it.
Well, that's debatable. I mean,
no, it's not debatable. I mean, this is pretty simple statistics. You're 10 times more likely to kill yourself with a gun than you are to kill or even warn off a criminal with a gun.
Well, the two people who wrote the best book on this the book is called Armed. It's by Gary Kleck and Don Cates.
Mm-hmm.
Both of those guys, I believe Kleck he's very, very progressive, and he's a member of Amnesty International and other progressive organizations. Mm-hmm. And he says basically in this book, and he lays out the statistics, that is basically not true. The guns are used much more to ward off attacks, much, much more.
The
than
argument
people,
that he makes,
you know,
though, is that it's not reported.
Themselves, things like that.
And he's saying that the reason why it doesn't show
right.
up in the official statistics is that if somebody wards off a criminal with a gun, they don't then call the police and say, I'd like to report that I just warded off a criminal. I would submit
exactly,
to you that
exactly.
they actually do call the police and say, I just warded off a criminal. If your house has been broken into and you scare a guy off with a gun, you're still going to call the police and say, hey, my house just got broken into.
Okay.
I just don't buy his argument.
Yeah, but right. I mean, I respect your position on that, but,
you know, I think we're not that far from a consensus on this, Matt, and you know that we have societal problems in the United States and social problems that we need to solve, and we don't want to entirely disarm America. But, you know, I get back to the question of if I have to have a driver's license in order to drive a car because it's big enough and dangerous enough that it might kill somebody, why shouldn't I be required to have a license to own a gun?
I think that there are some gun control that I do support. One is criminal background checks and not allowing people with a history of violent crime or mental illness to own a gun. I agree with you on that.
Yeah, so here we are. I mean, you know, it's basically driver's license, gun license. But
we need to make sure that
Go ahead.
But we need to make sure that these restrictions are not so onerous that they prevent poor and working people from owning guns.
I agree with you. I agree with you. And on that point, we'll go to the break. Thanks, Matt. 16 minutes past the hour. Back 22 minutes past the hour. Turns out the Nazis did not create any new firearms laws until 1938. Interesting. So, thanks to Marian Delgado in the chat room. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And Xavier in Santa Cruz, California. Hey, Xavier, what's on your mind today?
Hey, hi, Tom. 2 points I wanted to make. They're kind of intertwined. The first was you talking about the difference between fascism and communism.
Yeah.
I agree with you that they are. There's a definite difference in terminology, but what I'd like to point out is my understanding under fascism, the corporation controls the government, and under socialism or communism, the government controls the corporation, and the net result is the same. You have, like, bureaucrats and a small group of people controlling both.
Yeah, by and large, I mean, if you look at, for example, the former Soviet Union, and you look at Mussolini's Italy, which was a fascist state. In fact, he invented the word. You could say that there are some parallels. The theory of communism is that, you know, the average person would all own a stake in the various enterprises through the state. It just didn't work out that way. You know, it's communism works in small communities. I mean, kibbutzes in Israel, for example, are communist, and they work very well. But once you get a community large enough that somebody can operate anonymously.
150 people, I think it was.
Yeah, 150 to 200 people is the typical threshold.
Tom, the reason I brought
that up is down.
My main point has to do with the gun control issue.
Yeah.
And this is where I sort of want to disagree with you. I'm a pacifist. I've owned guns in my past, and one of the things that I think is that in a situation where you should try to go for the Gandhian sense of how to win your country back as a first step. But I've talked to you about this before, and I really think that in a situation where they've got atom bombs and tanks and all, and you might have at the most maybe RPGs or something, you know?
Yeah.
In a situation like that, if you just got a handgun or a assault rifle, you can ward off the government in your community to the degree that what you can do is, if they don't know where the guns are coming from, you're familiar with the local territory, you have the consent of other people in your neighborhood. Now, you might want to legislate, you know, gun licensing to the degree like the sheriff, but not the national level, because you want to move into a community where people agree with you and
right.
You have consensus. And I think
in those circumstances,
you can protect yourself against the federal government because they know that they're going to lose a lot of people. There's going to be, you know.
Here's the problem with that logic, though, and where it's going to go, Xavier. Look at Iraq. You've got a whole bunch of different groups of people who are fighting against us, the occupiers, and many of them fighting against what they perceive to be an illegitimate government that they believe is oppressing them. You've got largely the Sunnis who are saying, okay, the Shias have taken control of the government, and the Sunni presence is a token presence, and therefore we're going to fight. You've got several different factions who started out with that ideal, essentially, that you're talking about of, hey, we're being oppressed by a nasty government, and so we're going to fight back. And they're very, very well armed. And what happened over time was as they started having some success in fighting against the oppressors, whether that was their perception of us as the oppressors or whether it's their perception of the Maliki government as the oppressors, if they started to have some success, they started to turn their guns on each other.
Right.
I mean, you know, a well-armed society in the midst of civil chaos is a prescription for a civil war. We saw the exact same thing happen in the United States in the 1860s.
Well,
and I'm not saying that, you know, stripping all the guns out of the society is the answer. What I'm saying is building civil society is the answer.
And I think the difference between the United States and Canada is a similar difference between the Iraq and the United States. It's a matter of degree. In Canada, they have a lot of cohesion nationwide within all the different communities.
Well, yes and no. I mean, the people living in Quebec would argue that very strongly with you.
But I don't think they take it to the degree of, like, coming to arms.
They tried to secede from their country.
Well, they, okay. I think they're much more civil, though, there.
Yes, and again, because the infrastructure of civil society is intact in Canada, because they have a national health care system, because they have a good social safety net, because there is a pervasive sense across Canada that we're all in this together.
Yeah,
and those are the reasons, in my opinion, why they're not killing each other, even though they have a lot of weapons.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, there's a lesson in there for us in the United States. Got to move along. Thanks, Xavier, for the call. Good to hear from you. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff, just a minute here before we have to take a break.
Okay, simple point. Look at the most heavily armed countries in the world, Iraq with Saddam Hussein. The citizens did have a lot of automatic weapons.
Yes.
Look at Afghanistan. The citizenry is heavily armed. They both had totalitarian, dictatorial governments.
Yeah, in other words, the argument that is made by the Reich that you know, the first thing Hitler did was get control of guns. Actually, it wasn't until 1938 that they started passing gun control laws in Germany. That argument is nonsense.
Look at the least armed countries in the world, they generally tend to be the most democratic.
Yes, Norway, Sweden, Switzerland.
England, Japan.
Yeah, where it's very, very difficult to own a gun. Yes.
Yeah, it's basically an irrelevant issue. I mean, the guns are not going to protect us from the government. And, again, look at the factual examples. The heavily armed countries had dictators, even when the citizenry was armed.
That's right. And when the citizenry did try to rise up against the government, it again devolved into civil war and the kind of chaos that we never want to have happen here in the United States. It's not about weapons. It's about civil society.
Yep.
Jeff, thank you for the call. Good to hear from you. 28 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program.
Can you feel what's happening here? Everything is changing all around you. It's in the air, electricity.
It's 35 minutes past the hour, coming up on SAME. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where being liberal, being progressive, your choice, never felt so good. Never felt so good. We get it. We understand what civil society means. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. John in Las Vegas, Nevada. Hey, John.
Hi, Tom. You heard a question.
John, you're breaking up pretty badly there. Tell you what, let me put you on hold here. It sounds like you're on a cell phone. I'll put you on hold. We'll come back to you in a couple of minutes. Maybe you can get into a little better spot. Lee in Vancouver, British Columbia. Hey, Lee, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I wanted to speak briefly about the ATS system that you were talking about.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about this new program by which the Department of Homeland Security is going to scan basically everybody and everything. It started out as a cargo screening program, and so nobody thought twice about it. Said, okay, that's cool. You're going to screen all cargo, and you're going to define which cargo is suspicious and track it and create a whole system for that. That makes sense. And they did it, and everybody, you know, kind of saluted. And now they're saying, oh, by the way, we're going to put human beings into this system as well.
Yeah, you know, that underlying logic behind the system is what bothers me. Anyone can be forbidden to fly or, for that matter, to move across the borders because it applies to land travel also.
Right.
There's a notion that is reflected in the suspension of habeas corpus that the government can simply declare you to be a terrorist, a criminal, or whatever, and you have no way of defending yourself against those charges.
Right.
It is basically a denial of your right to know what the charges are against you. I mean, they're basically convicting people.
It's the Fourth Amendment. Yeah.
Yeah, convicting people on declaration.
Yeah.
Which is incredible.
Yeah.
You have the ATS system on January 18th. America's going to be required to produce passports to come back into the country.
In and out of Canada, you mean?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of things that are happening right now that basically restrict the ability of Americans to travel.
Yeah, they're locking this country down, and you have to ask yourself why. Why would the Bushies be so interested in locking this country down? They say we've got to stop the terrorists, but, I mean, they had plenty of information before 9/11 that 9/11 was going to happen, and they didn't bother to do anything about that. I don't think that any of this lockdown stuff that they're doing now is going to prevent anything like that.
Well, in the article I was reading on ATS, they cannot produce one terrorist that they have caught.
That's right.
The system.
Yeah, you know. not one, nor for that matter, one piece of terrorist cargo, you know, of dangerous cargo.
Exactly.
Now, good point, Lee. Thank you very much for calling and making it. I appreciate it. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Press in San Francisco, California. Hey, Press.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Oh, killer. Beautiful. Listen, I wanted to refer to, somebody talked about fear as being one of the tools of oppression and one of the motivations for people to own guns. It's so funny that maybe perhaps this is why a lot of these conservatives are kind of crazy, is because of that, what you would call, I guess, what they call cognitive dissonance. They're afraid of their government because they know what it has done and can do, but at the same time, they're afraid of their fellow citizens because of disinformation and the disconnect they have.
Right.
Go home and turn on your television. We'll tell you about your neighbor.
Well, and I think one of the fundamental problems is that we have not, ever since the purges of our high schools during the Reagan years, you know, when the David Horowitz types went after civics classes and civics class, you know, textbooks, we haven't really taught government. We haven't taught civics. We haven't.
Exactly.
I don't think the average high school graduate today could describe to you what the phrase civil society means.
That makes me to my next point is I'm in a political science class. I've been in a Vietnam veteran and everything. I'm quite much older than a lot of people in my class. And it's disheartening and even scary.
At a college level, I'm assuming.
Yes, right. Community college, in pursuit of a higher nursing degree. But I am appalled and kind of disheartened and even saddened by the ignorance. And some of my classmates, they're just out of high school or perhaps that age, a lot of them. They don't even remember the first Desert S storm is what I would call it, let alone Vietnam or anything else.
Yeah.
And they are, on one hand, ready to surrender everything to the government. Well, I don't see why I have to worry about a national ID card, for example, because I'm not doing anything wrong. What do I care?
Right.
You know, and on the same hand, they also are afraid of other, I don't know, they're depending on the government to, on one hand, scrutinize everything and protect them from their neighbor, but on the other hand, somehow let them be free consumers. It's kind of crazy.
It is such a dangerous mentality, and it comes out of this deliberate obfuscation. You've got guys on the right who are railing about the war on Christmas. They're going, no, I'm serious.
I know.
And they're going on and on and on about, you know, whether or not, you know, at what stage in fetal development is a fetus to experience pain. They want to talk about, I mean, this is what Congress is coming back into session to debate. While they've got 9 spending bills, the Social Security Administration is going to have to shut down. The Veterans Administration is going to have $3 billion in needs because of Iraqi vets coming back. The Republicans don't want to talk about this. They don't want to talk about the things that have to do with actual civil society, because ultimately they want that civil society to be replaced by a corporate society. And that's the end of democracy. It's just plain old flat out the end of democracy. And that's what they have in store for us. That's what they have in mind for us. And it is so obvious to see. And the first part of the destruction of it is buying into Ronald Reagan's assertion that government can't do anything right. He even went so far as to say, and because I'm doing the show here from the studio in San Francisco, I don't have my audio clips with me, but, you know, Reagan at one point said, there are no good people in government, because if they were, they would have been hired away by private industry. I mean, that's the mentality that he had. Oddly, it didn't occur to him that he might be talking about himself. You know. But the fact of the matter is that the idea of civil society, the idea of us, you know, working together, the idea of government actually being a proactive and positive force in our lives, and for the benefit of people, not for the oppression of people, is something that they just scrubbed out of the public perception.
That's another thing about this class I'm in, is these kids, I have to call them kids, you know, even though some of them are in their 30s. But anyway, the point is that a lot of them, in fact, almost all of them, do not realize that there was a time when the government actually did help the citizens. And we did help each other through what you have rightly referred to as the commons. We do have common interest. We can't forget that.
Yeah, we pulled ourselves out of the
Republic. But they don't remember.
Yeah, they don't remember,
and they're not taught. I remember where I was when JFK was killed 43 years ago. I was in a civics class.
and a little in a junior high school in Oklahoma. And I remember my teacher was weeping, and we were studying civics. They don't teach. I don't remember the last time I've even. I don't know if they even teach it in school anymore.
They do, but it's mostly what year did Columbus discover America kind of stuff. You know, memorize these 35 dates so you can pass the standardized test for No Child Left Behind.
You won't hear about the Ludlow or the Shays Rebellion or
get questions that stimulate critical thinking. Press, yeah. I got to run along, but I appreciate the call. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tom.
It's important stuff you're raising. Sean in Orcas Island, Washington, is it?
That's correct.
Hey, Sean, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, I think you're great.
Thank you.
You're welcome, and it's really interesting. I want to talk about the Homeland Security Automated Targeting System.
Yes.
I actually went to the website where the Homeland Security had proposed a regulation, and I printed it out, and thank God I did, even though I can't put my hand on it right now, because it's been taken off the Internet.
Gee, what a surprise.
I just tried to get to it while I was waiting for you so I could read it to you. So when I find it, I can send it to you or scan it or whatever, because I think you find it very, very interesting. But also, I'm in the medical tourism business, and I take people to Costa Rica for dental work and for plastic surgery and heart surgery and all that other stuff,
mm-hmm.
which means I take people out of the United States, and they go there because it's so much cheaper.
Right.
And so they could target me, so I couldn't take these people out of the country anymore, so they couldn't go there for no reason whatsoever.
Well, they could target any of us. I mean, if you've got somebody that is a persistent critic of the administration, for example, and you want to shut them down, all you have to do is define them as a potential terrorist and freeze their bank accounts.
Correct.
Your credit cards get locked down, your checking account, all your assets get locked down. You can't pay the mortgage on your house. You can't pay your car payment. You can't do it. You can't move, basically. You get locked down and frozen. The federal government has that kind of power right now. And no number of guns in the world are going to help you out. I mean, we need to take back democracy in the United States, and we need to stop this creeping fascism, frankly. And it is not going to happen as a result of, gee, let's have more guns in our society.
That's correct.
To bring these two things together.
I was watching Amy Goodman this morning. I watch her every morning, as she's wonderful.
She's brilliant.
And I was so impressed by these people in Mexico that have really, they have cojones, and they go up against their government, and they're having a...
And they're getting shot at down in Oaxaca.
Exactly.
I mean, it's they're still standing up, and I think that Oaxaca, and I think some of these regions are on the edge of a Gandhi moment, time will tell. But they have some lessons to teach us Americans about standing up.
Well, you're right.
We
need to get involved. We have to get involved. We must be involved.
Absolutely. Yes. Sean, thank you so much for the call. Good to hear from you. 1-866-440-8466, TomHartmann.com, our live chat room. We'll be back right after this, 45 minutes past the hour.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them blue for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And welcome back. It's the end of the week. TGIF, Shabbat Shalom, happy weekend, and special thanks. Thanks to my parents for birthing me, for bringing me into the world. Thanks to Alan Roberts for running the board here and keeping us going in San Francisco as we're doing this remote. Thanks to Lauren Kirshner and Andrew Dunn in New York at Air America Radio, Louise Hartman and David Poole producing the program, Mike Toth, who's putting together our archives, Ben Birch and Shelby Lepre over at radiopower.org and whiteRoseSociety.org for getting the show out. And thanks to you for listening and to our sponsors. 1-866-440-8466. Mark in Eureka, California, KGOE. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Yeah, I'd like to say Shabbat Shalom to you too, brother, and a Merry
Thank
Christmas
you.
To all the other people out there. And then define, in my opinion, civil war. In my opinion, civil war is central bankers in ivory towers playing off factions one against the other. It's a basic divide and conquer program for what? For short-term gain in the material world. So that's my definition of civil war. But if we're going to talk about the possible armed resistance by U.S. citizens, I think we've got to examine the underlying principles, and that would be, for example, the Constitution that guarantees rule by the people. And then we have civil society, which is based on the rule of law. And the rule of law allows for self-defense. And then, of course, our leaders took an oath and swore to uphold the rule of law according to the Constitution. And there's a little kicker right here. The UN Charter has been ratified in this country, and it is therefore the law of the land. It is part of the U.S. jurisprudence. And so the Iraq
something that a lot of Americans don't realize, because we don't teach civics classes anymore, that when the U.S. government signs a treaty, that treaty becomes becomes the law of the land, and it actually can supersede state laws and local laws.
Yep, and the Iraq War zone not only violated international law, but it also violated U.S. law. So
what
in effect we have is no law enforcement. We have the evidence, but no law enforcement. So what are citizens to do in the face of, you could say, insurrection by their leaders? So what I do is I advocate Dr. King's approach. He is my hero, nonviolent direct action to effect social change. But
yes.
If corrupt leaders, you know, go and use the police as the police and the military, which are paid for by the people, and use the police and military in violation of the law against the people, armed resistance is the natural response. And what I say would happen in that regard would be we'd have the military and the police take the side of the people, because they would see the just cause of the people, just like we saw the just cause of the African Americans who backed the civil rights movement led by Dr. Martin Luther King, who myself as a Christian see as a hero, because we have a world dominated almost, you could say, by warmongers for Jesus.
Mark, let me agree with you, but with a caveat, and that is that if we had a national draft, so if we had a military that was made up of and representative of the broad population as a whole, I think that it would be very difficult for the Bolsheviks or anybody like them to use our military against us, even though they did with the Military Commissions Act and then with the John Warner Defense Appropriation Act do away with, for all practical purposes, posse comitatus, which is the law passed in the 1870s that says that the government can't use the military against its own people. You know,
right.
They've done away with that. But as long as we have an elite all-volunteer army that basically becomes a mercenary force, I'm concerned, frankly, about that.
I'm concerned too, but I believe in our people in uniform, and I say that I see a military coup that will overthrow and destroy this autocratic regime if they turn on the just cause of the American law-abiding, hard-working people. Thank you, Tom.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you, Mark. Todd in Marina, California. Hey, Todd.
Yeah, I was going to discuss something else, but I'd like to respond to the comment. I don't have faith that the police would stand up and defend the American people.
Yeah, I don't either. I mean, but with regard to the military, I think if we had a military draft, I don't think that there's enough police in the United States to lock down the country. They'd have to bring in the army.
If you look at the civil rights movement, who was out there beating up black Americans and white abolitionists,
right,
but the local sheriff?
Yep.
You know, to the gun control issue, I agree with you that the root of it is a civil society, one that believes in peace. And unfortunately, we're not there yet.
Yeah.
I hunted for years, and I no longer hunt. You know, I would much rather watch a flock of Canadian geese land than hunt them. You know, I still own some firearms, but I've taken to my father's house. You know, after September 11th, I did go bring them home for a few weeks, you know, until I felt, you know, okay, this was an isolated incident. We're not going to get invaded. But I think that our current climate is rather scary, because it's not really citizen against citizen. It's the government is the antagonist in most of our conflict. I mean, if you look at if it's religious beliefs or whatever it is right now in our country.
No, we have to make a distinction here, Todd. It's not the government. It is the people who have seized control of the government.
Yes.
The government itself is essentially a neutral institution. And in the United States, at least in theory, and in large part, actually, in fact, the government is we the people. We own it. It is these right-wing ideologues who have seized control of it. And the response is to take back that control. And the first step of that is what just happened in the elections. And now we have to put into place those elements of civil society that will allow us to continue that process. For example, deprivatizing our electoral system, our voting system. I mean, it's insane that private for-profit corporations are telling us in secret how we voted. just as one example. We need to depoliticize Secretary of State's offices if they're going to be running elections. We need to go back to paper. We need to go back to teaching civics in our classrooms. We need to start enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, and in particular with regard to media corporations, saying we don't want defense contractors owning television networks. It just doesn't make sense. Let's stop these giant combines, these giant corporations that are larger than nation states, from basically becoming the tail that wags the dog of American government. 58 minutes past the hour. We'll see you on Monday. Remember, democracy begins with you.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
And therefore, tag, you're it! See you on Monday. Have a great weekend.